hospital upgrade in Ipswich. Extra lanes for Kingsford Smith Drive, a new high school in Dutton Park, one of six proposed for the southeast. Koalas having land cleared out from under them. All news stories that you would have heard in the last couple of months, and all because there are more of us. There will be 4 million people living in Brisbane by 2046. It's 2.4 at the moment. People are immigrating here, that's a big part of it. And there's also the fact that a baby is born in Australia every 104 seconds. Oh, there's another one now. Hello. So if we in Brisbane are heading where Sydney-siders are now, can you put your forecaster's hat on and tell us, what problems do you see? The number is 1300 222 612. You can text 0467 922 612. What are you most worried about if Brisbane is headed the way Sydney is going when it comes, or Sydney is now, when it comes to population? 1300 222 612.
Emma Griffiths. Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane.
Four Corners is talking population tonight, and that's Ben Knight's baby. Ben, hello.
Hey, Emma.
Now, you've examined all the pressures that we're pretty familiar with, I guess, roads and schools and housing, and then asked that crucial question, who's in charge? So who's actually developing a strategy? Is there anyone?
Well, different cities in different states have their own strategies, but they don't come close to coming up with a national plan on how we're going to deal with the sorts of population increases that you've talked about. So, as Bob Carr says, you know, the planning documents, the strategies, they're competent enough documents, but what they do is they spell out where the high rise is going to be. Now, that's a pretty cynical view. Bob Carr is someone who does not believe that a big Australia is a good thing. But what we're doing tonight is pulling together the data that are out there and just trying to present a picture of where we are headed and what that's going to mean. And if we are to continue down that road, what are the decisions that we need to make? What are the trade-offs we need to make? Because as you would well know, and you're talking about Brisbane essentially doubling in size within the space of a few decades, it's going to be a different city. We're all going to be in different cities. Where I live in Melbourne, it's going to be, on the current projections, a city of 8 million people by the middle of this century, which is nearly double what it is now. And I'm sure many of your listeners would have been to Melbourne recently and seen just how big it is. So, do you keep going out? Do you go up? Do you, in fact, wind migration back? And if you do that, what impact does that have on the economy? Because at the moment, the economy does rely to a certain extent on population growth. So, which is why some people call it, like Dick Smith, he calls it a Ponzi scheme. If you rely just on simply increasing immigration to keep the economy ticking over, then that's not really a plan. But either way, even if you do wind immigration back in Australia, we're still on this track towards a significantly larger population than we have at the moment. And if we're going to maintain quality of life, we've got to make some choices.
And Ben, I see that business leaders, one in particular, has said that Australia's done an abysmal job so far in planning for increasing population. What are business leaders doing to push for a process, a national approach?
Well, the way that they feel it most at the moment, they're a bit concerned about the changes that the government's making to temporary migration visas, because what the government has done is abolished the 457 visa and introduced a new series of short-term visas that, among other things, make it more difficult for people who come here on temporary visas to turn that into permanent residency. Now, that's a pretty esoteric argument, but essentially what they're saying is that makes it extremely difficult for them to attract the talent that they need to build the industries of the future. But the question that you raise is a very, very good one. You know, there's an argument that says, well, of course, you know, business gets all of the benefit of it. It gets the expanded consumer market to buy its products. It gets an expanded labour market. And doesn't actually invest in any of the infrastructure that we need. But look, I think one of the things that you'll hear people who are not concerned about a big population say is don't blame population for planning failures. That is, you know, yes, we all are stuck in traffic. We all are affected in one way or another by high house prices, whether it's for ourselves or whether it's for our kids who are trying to break into the market. You know, all of these things affect us. But the argument is that, you know, that's because we haven't done it right. Now, back in the 1960s, you know, we were talking about exactly the same things, and the situation was exactly the same. You had a Commonwealth government that was setting high immigration numbers, but it was up to the states to keep up and to build the roads and the schools and the hospitals and the police stations and the train stations and all of those things. And at the moment, you can see that lag happening because we've been on this trajectory of high population growth since about 2006. So right now we're having exactly the same issues, that same disconnect between the Commonwealth and the states. Back then, at least you had a federal government that was talking about it. At the moment, not so much. There is no national population policy. There is no population minister. And there's no one leading that conversation about the trade-offs that we're going to have to make. The only way these cities are going to function is if we reduce our reliance on motor vehicles, and I think most people understand that. The only way that, you know, you're going to be able to get people to live in higher density houses is if you do it right and if you make sure that there are schools available for the kids, that there's green space nearby, that they can, if they're, you know, if we're going to say to people, you can't use your car as much, then you've got to give them the alternative. And that's talking about building the kind of mass transit systems that we don't have at the moment. And that can only happen if you get a Commonwealth and state governments working together and thinking way down the track. That, I think, is what people talk about when they say we need a population policy.
Okay. Ben Knight, thank you so much for kicking off this discussion in a very big way.
Thank you, Emma.
Ben Knight is Four Corners reporter, and you can see his report on this tonight. There's also various articles rolling out across ABC News online over the next week, and in the next 45 minutes or so on Focus, a discussion around planning for a big population in Brisbane. You're with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane, and we do have a veritable planning committee on the show today to talk about some of the issues involved in this. Phil Davies is the head honcho with Infrastructure Australia. Hello, Phil.
Hi, good morning, Emma.
And we have another Phil Haywood, who's from the QUT School of Urban Planning. Hello, Phil.
Hello.
Might have to do Phil Davies and Phil Haywood to make sure the right Phil answers. Laurel Johnson is an urban and social planner at the UQ School of Earth and Environment. Hello, Laurel.
Hi, Emma.
And Ellen, Charles Edwards is a population geographer and demographer. You got the stats.
I do.
Excellent. All right, well, starting with you first, Phil, there's been a report come out from your organisation. I just want to look at Brisbane specifically and first of all talk about the population projection for around 4 million in 30 years' time. Are you talking there about Brisbane City, Greater Brisbane, or is it the whole southeast?
So what we're looking at there, Emma, is what you might describe as Greater Brisbane. And I think that the answer to that question comes down to the work that we released a few weeks ago, looking at what our future choices might be.
Okay. And Phil, Infrastructure Australia obviously has a point of contact with the federal government. Listening to Ben Knight there, who's looked into this for Four Corners, saying that there really is no population national plan at the moment. There's no population minister. How do you see that?
Yeah, that's very much the recommendation we put forward in our 15-year plan a couple of years ago and really have lifted the focus on in this recent cities paper, where we're calling for the federal government to play a much greater role in population planning particularly, and working much in a much closer way with our local government and state governments.
Are they doing anything about it?
So I think that the most recent initiative out of the federal government is under the banner of what they're calling city deals. And I think that's a good step forward. So what that's looking at is getting the federal government sat at the table with state governments and local government to talk about the future and talk about those choices that we have to make. I think the missing ingredient in this approach, though, is still getting a good engagement with the community. And I think that's something we were hoping to promote through releasing this Future Cities paper and through dialogues such as this one with yourself today.
That's where we can come in, hey? Well, Ellen, you got the stats. So can you talk me through what's happening in Brisbane at the moment? What is happening in Greater Brisbane?
Yeah, thanks, Emma. I might actually just talk about Australia first, if you don't mind, very quickly. We're growing up to 45 million, and that's mostly international migration that's driving that, so two-thirds of growth, and that, clearly that comes to play into Brisbane and the local area. So SEQ, we're expecting to get up around 6 million by mid-century. Brisbane, greater capital area, is around 4 million, as said. So a lot of that growth is actually, it's got three components. It's natural increase, so babies being born and people dying. It's international migrants coming to make a home here, and also internal migration. And that's so moves from other part of Australia to Brisbane and SEQ.
And Laurel Johnson, as an urban and social planner, when you get those sorts of numbers coming at you, what's the first thing you think of?
Fear. I guess I'm sure that many of us in the region have some trepidation about those kinds of numbers. But I also have some confidence in Southeast Queensland. We have had a few decades now of a model of cooperative regional planning, whereby the state very much sits at the table across portfolios with our council leaders. The engagement of community hasn't probably been as enduring as it could be within that regional planning process, but we have in our region managed to at least keep things civil at the table and to talk about population in the sense of infrastructure coordination and trying to agree on where the future growth might be best placed. So a few years ago, we were all fearful of the idea of a 200-kilometre city from Noosa to the border, and there was some pretty turgid discussions happened at that time about, well, what we should be directing growth to the west. So let's take the pressure off the coast. And so those kinds of conversations are possible where people sit in the room together.
And has that happened?
It has happened, yes. And the product of that is the regional plan shaping SEQ, the current iteration of that regional planning, which has gone on, as I said, for a few decades.
Okay. And do you think that push to the west has been successful?
I think there are some elements that are missing in that. The train line to Springfield was obviously terrific. We don't have this. A missing link in that train to push it further, that corridor out to Ripley and then back up through to Ipswich. So the transport setting, we haven't necessarily got that right at the same time as the population has gone there. So we do lag in our infrastructure, particularly around transport, and we are still very much dependent on the centre of Brisbane for our employment. We need to look at how to better decentralise the jobs so that they're close to where people are living, which is in the suburbs.
Interesting you should mention jobs there. Bob has sent a message in, and you can as well, to text. It's 0467 922 612 if you want to chime in. To call 1300 222 612. What are you most worried about looking at population increases over the next few decades in the southeast Queensland area, in Brisbane? Bob says, would love to know where all the jobs will come from, with the effect that robotisation, so artificial intelligence, is going to have on us, even without doubling our population. But yes, the jobs pressure as well. Where is that all going to come from? Phil Haywood from QT School of Urban Planning, you were in the Brisbane Times recently talking about how there's just this lack of political leadership that you see in the levels of government around Queensland and Brisbane. What effect is that having?
I think we get a whole lot of piecemeal solutions. Everybody trots out their own chosen unique answer just before an election, and then it's forgotten about afterwards. We really need what Laurel was saying the regional plan makes possible, which is, first of all, the collaboration in developing a joint picture. But the regional plan is much weaker than its predecessors in actually specifying answers and committing to infrastructure expenditure. So we need to have steering groups committed to action with the different levels of government, making strategies which are linked to infrastructure expenditure. You know, it's that's where the rubber hits the road or the wheel spins on the track. We just got to make certain that we don't carry on with individualized programs. We've got a very good democracy, multi-level democracy. We span very well the whole range of activities from transport to governance and social life and recreation and conservation. It's a big issue. It's a big tableau, and we need that tableau to be matched by groups who are given the opportunity, reporting back to politicians, to reach consensus and to guide the infrastructure expenditure, so that we link the urban growth boundary, which limits growth into the attractive area beyond, to public transport expenditure, which makes it possible for people to develop more intensively within that area, around specific nodes, so that the thing is integrated. We're going to spend the money anyway. Let's spend it in a way which adds up to something which fulfills our values.
We're going to spend the money anyway. Phil Davies, asking the question of people listening today, what are you most worried about if Brisbane is heading to what Sydney is today? What are you most worried about when you look at population projections?
I think this has already been said by a couple of the panellists, but that the lack of a clear long-term vision and a plan is worrying. I think it's fair to say as a country we've responded well to growth in the past. We've dealt with these kind of population increases before, as Ben Knight said, but right now we're reacting to growth, and as Phil Hayward said, we're very much taking a piecemeal approach to planning. We need a more sophisticated approach, thinking about, you know, where are people going to be working, where they're going to live in, what kind of infrastructure do we need to support the kind of lifestyle people want. And going back to the work we released, we try to promote this conversation around different versions of the future, one based on a low density future where people will continue to live in quarter acre blocks on the outskirts of our cities and you know, drive everywhere, or we could go to a high density scenario where people live in high density and would enjoy having timetable free turn up and go public transport services, or something in the middle where we have a medium density future and we locate jobs closer to where people live. So,
and which one do you prefer for a place like Brisbane?
So we're not picking a winner in any of those. That isn't the purpose of the exercise. I think people should have choice, and people should have the opportunity to influence what the future looks like. At the moment, I think that's the missing piece of the conversation that's going on, and governments and bureaucracies are responding to growth in a piecemeal fashion. Because
I guess if you leave it to people, though, Phil Davies, everybody has their own self-interest really at play, don't they? Like, I'm lucky enough to live in the suburbs in a house that has a backyard. I catch the train to work most times. That's great. So I'm quite happy for there to be high-rise density in the inner suburbs. But if you ask someone in the inner suburbs, they're like, no way, I can't park my own car at the moment. So where's the vision coming from then? Are you leaving that to the politicians?
So I think that comes back to this conversation between all levels of government. I think that's the vision we need to develop. We need to understand, we need to take on board the community's input, but we need to paint the picture of the vision, but also map out what those choices mean. That if we're going to have higher density, then we have to invest in timetable-free turn-up-and-go public transport services. If we're going to continue to sprawl, then we're going to have to invest in roads, and people are going to have to accept they're going to be sitting in congestion for longer periods of the day, and, you know, not get home in time to see the kids before they go to bed, or you know, have the reliability that, you know, they can leave at the same time every day and get to the destination in a reliable way. So these are choices that we can make. But I think, to the earlier point, we need to understand what the choices are, what the investment implications are, and paint that picture for the community so that we can actually plan for the longer term. At the moment, we're responding in a short-term way to growth that's already happening.
And Phil, we've got a couple of calls coming in, but as head of Infrastructure Australia, you do have that point of contact with the federal government. Over recent years, we've had leadership change after leadership change. Recently, a major distraction, I guess, with the former Deputy Prime Minister. Does that impact on building a long-term policy like this?
So we, as an independent body, we obviously interact with the federal government, but we're governed by an independent board with 12 people on it, and we work very closely with our state and territory colleagues in a consensus way. We're looking at the evidence, particularly looking at the evidence of the impact of growth right now, but also engaging in that longer term conversation off the back of work like the work we just published a few weeks ago, which they're not our forecast, they're from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. They're real population growth that are going to happen, and it's our job to engage people in planning for that.
I imagine it would make life easier though if a government was stable enough to have the time to think about this sort of stuff.
So I think one of the challenges with long-term planning is that it transcends many governments, and it's difficult for politicians to plan for the long term, because very often, even if they back infrastructure projects, they're not the ones who cut the ribbons when the projects open. So I think that's why this needs to be joined up, not at one level of government, but across all levels of government, and I think local government has a much bigger role to play than perhaps it has historically. And I think from a Queensland point of view, Southeast Queensland's blessed with some of the largest local government areas in the country, and with Brisbane City Council being a case in point. And I think it's important that local government plays a big role in this conversation with the community, but also it has a seat at the table with the federal government and state government to actually develop these long-term plans so that they can be, you know, transcend political cycles and actually be something everyone can commit to.
We can hope. Your turn now. Julie in Brookfield, what are you most worried about?
My biggest concern, or one of the concerns, is related to food production. Historically, as a kid, I remember basically there would be areas that they're building on now, building houses to house our population, used to be our good production land. So whether it be just out west or along the coast. And I'm just wondering whether there's any planning going ahead when our fertile land is being used for buildings rather than food production.
Okay, so food security. I mean, what do you think, Phil Haywood?
I'd like to make a cheerful point on that, because things were getting worse and worse in the second half of the 20th century, with Brisbane just sprawling out meaninglessly at very low densities into beautiful land, and the whole of the coastal plain being in a sense devastated by growth. And the first regional plan, going back to 2006, you know, took its courage in its hands, and it declared what it called an urban footprint, the famous urban growth boundary. It protected agricultural land. Things have got better. We've got now a number of good things. We've got healthy waterways working well in Brisbane. We've got the conservation of rural resources. There's a lot of food that we eat being produced in that area that would have been devastated if we hadn't had regional planning. I'm a little bit disappointed that the latest regional plan keeps the name urban footprint, but it gives away an awful lot of extra space because it wasn't able to coordinate properly to densify population without ever cramming in the inner area. It was a kind of a, let's give the land away because the pressure is there from the developers and it's difficult to actually insist that we are going to have public transport going in, and we're not sure we're going to designate proper cluster developments.
Okay.
So yeah, all those things could have been done. So, yes, we can do those things. Absolutely. Planning is about the transference of values into activities and the designation of land uses for that. So let's do that. That means we've got to go back and get what the other Phil was talking about so well. We've got to get public consensus. Got to get the energy coming in from thoroughgoing public consultation.
And from the other Phil then, Phil Davies from Infrastructure Australia. I mean, your most recent report is around cities, but is it also looking at areas for food production? Does that come into a planning process?
I think absolutely comes into the land use planning process. It wasn't something, or has been something we focused on in this particular piece of work, but is obviously central to planning the future, where we use our land for the long term. And I think importantly, you know, that what we have looked at with this work is where people are going to educate their children, where we need health and health facilities, and the broader social infrastructure. But in terms of food, obviously that's critical, and we need to be thinking about how we get our goods to consumers and to markets as well. Freight, more broadly, freight and logistics isn't something we've done very well in terms of planning in recent years as a country. It's quite piecemeal and reactive as well.
Mm. Bill in Ashgrove has also got a question. Bill, what's your worry or concern?
I listen to these discussions and I just despair, Emma. The fundamental proposition that's being put forward on all of these discussions is that we can increase our population forever. I mean, this is madness. You cannot do that. At some stage, you have to level out your population. So instead of focusing on the infrastructure we need for 50 or 100 million, we should be focusing our efforts on building models that will sustain a balanced population.
Mm.
It's just so basic. I can't believe we just keep talking around this nonsense about planning for 50 million. I've just had a week in Melbourne, and I remember Melbourne, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, as a beautiful city and a lovely place to visit. My God, if that's where we're heading, the only improvement I can see is you get a better cup of coffee. The rest of it's horrendous.
Oh, dearie me, sacrilege. The best coffee is in Brisbane, surely.
Well, exactly. And all these guys, you had a guy in early from BDA or whatever they were, they pretend to be independent. They're not independent at all. Why is he living in Brisbane? Because there's only about 1 million people here. We go to 5 million, you've basically stuffed Brisbane and everything from Noosa to Tweed.
Well, are you saying Infrastructure Australia there? Phil, yeah. Davies is on the line, but you're in, yeah, Sydney, Phil. You don't live in Brisbane, do you?
Based in Sydney.
So yeah,
Phil's probably trying to work out how we can get to Brisbane.
Oh, I'm coming tomorrow, so we're looking forward to it.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Jokes aside, we must face the fact that you cannot grow your population forever. We must stop some stage. So if we're going to stop at some stage, why not stop sooner rather than later?
Thank you very much, Bill.
Emma, could I comment on that
issue? Just a second, Phil. I'll just go to Laurel Johnson. Laurel, you wanted to say something about this?
I think Bill's got a great point, and I think that's really part of the debate we need to have in Australia. And we don't. It's so politicised and it's so charged when we have this debate. But
it's around immigration and birth rates, isn't it?
You know,
is it immigration and birth rates?
It tends,
or what
well,
is it?
Oh, yeah. Ellen's got the stats.
Yeah, well, look, I think we should definitely be having a debate about population, and we haven't done this for 10 years. We tried it 10 years ago and it didn't really go anywhere. So a natural increase is pretty stable. We increase by about 150,000 people every year due to births being more births than deaths. Immigration is what's been driving growth, and we can make policy alterations. If we do want smaller number of migrants, we can do that, and that comes, it has its benefits, it has its costs. So I think we should definitely be having this conversation. We shouldn't be scared to have this conversation.
Mm. So Phil Davies, sorry, I will come to you, Phil. Sure. Haywood, but Phil Davies, looking at that, I mean, there are sort of two conversations happening at once, aren't there? There's essentially, we've got a plan for this big population that we're heading towards, but then there's the step back and do we really need to have this big population? Like Bob Carr on Four Corners Tonight is calling it a giant Ponzi scheme. It was Bob Carr that Ben Knight referred to there, wasn't it?
Dick Smith, I think, yeah.
Oh, Dick Smith. Dick Smith said that it was a giant Ponzi scheme. Because we're, you know, economic growth is going to come from immigration, but then immigration is also costing us more in lots of ways. What do you think of that debate, Phil Davies?
So I think it's certainly a debate that's ongoing and a debate for others to have. What we're focused on is how we need to plan for population growth, be it through immigration, natural births, and actually through an ageing population as well, where people are living longer. And that very much comes back to quality of life and lifestyle and the livability of our cities. And I think we're certainly seeing, with the significant growth in Melbourne and Sydney right now, a lot of downsizers actually moving into the cities and taking up apartment living where they've got access to, you know, the cultural assets, but also open space and green space. And
so IA doesn't essentially make recommendations around an ideal population, or what we should be striving for?
No, we're very much looking at how do we plan for what we know, and what we know at the moment is that our population is increasing quite significantly, and what we want to make sure is that we're planning well for it, because, you know, we do enjoy a good quality of life, and we've got four of the top 10 most livable cities in the world, and we'd like to make sure we plan to keep it that way.
So keeping it that way. Phil Haywood, what sparked your interest in that discussion?
It seems to me that solutions which offer to solve everything often really end up by solving nothing at all, because they're blinded by their own fantastic vision. And this answer which says, if only we stop the others having kids, if only we don't bring any immigrants in here, if only everybody else does what we say, it'll all be all right. But actually, the answer lies in the way we behave. It's not altogether the number of people doing things, it's what they're doing. And the problems of the southeast have been partly tackled because we've stopped taking all the rural land. Now we've got to start using healthy, active forms of transport and public transport. We've got to stop driving our big four-wheel drive to public meetings demanding population control policies. And we've got to start taking action about looking at the famous modal split, ugly phrase, but the division of how we move around between public transport and private transport and active transport. So there are all of these very specific things. It is not numerically the very small population increase. Under 2% a year is being forecast, and demographers can tell you that's entirely manageable.
Okay,
it's the way we are living now and the way we are making plans about how we can live more consistently with our natural environment and our fellow human beings.
And talking transport there as well, Laurel, you have actually done some work through the UQ School of Earth and Environment looking at social disadvantage and the access to public transport. What prompted that? What did you find?
What I found, Emma, is that access to public transport is not fairly distributed across our region. Surprise, surprise. And I'm sure people are sitting at home nodding their heads going, oh, yeah, we know that. I mean, we have
If you are, call 1300 222 612. Are you thinking that where you live and your family's take-home pay also guides your access to public transport? 1300 222 612. Just put it out there, Laurel.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. And it is one of the trade-offs that people make, you know, so they might choose to live in an area with limited public transport because the house is cheaper. They're not thinking through the actual cost of living, the weekly costs of their family budget that will go to transport. They might have to have two cars or more per household in order to trade off the cost of the cheap house, which is further from the destinations they need to get to. So I'm optimistic the way that Phil is, that we do have the mechanisms and we know what behavioural change needs to take place, but we have a value base that we probably need to look really closely to in Australia and think more about being sharing and sharing space with others, be they animals or our fellow human beings, and how do we make better use of space so that we have a kinder place where there's more sharing. The communities that I work in are quite disadvantaged. They feel really left out of the growth. They feel really left out of the goodies that are going into, in particular, the inner 5K. They're nowhere near that kind of, this wonderful infrastructure that we're sitting in here at South Bank.
So what sort of areas are you working in and looking at?
I'm working in the southwestern growth edge of Brisbane. So in the areas of Richlands, Ellengrove, Inala, in that kind of corridor. So in many ways, the growth goodies have leapfrogged them in some ways, jumped over them, and headed out to Springfield and the master plan communities where the private developers are doing a good job in putting infrastructure in place for populations. But my fear for the growth in southeast Queensland is that some people are missing out and they've perhaps missed out for decades, and we need some catch up. It needs to be a fair sharing place.
Mm. John in Sandstone Point is wanting to talk transport options as well. John, what do you want to say?
Well, basically, if you look at modes of public transport, that is cars and trains and buses, hasn't changed in 120 years. We've still got pneumatic tyres. We've still got steel wheels.
You're looking for a hovercraft. What do you want?
Well, why don't we look at things like the maglev, hover trains, VFTs to get people around quicker, instead of having three lanes of metal travelling at 60 kilometres an hour in peak hour traffic.
You're talking innovation there, John. Should give the PM a call. But yes, I mean, is that something we need different sorts of transport?
Most definitely.
They've got above ground rail systems to get everyone from point A to point B. We just keep, wasn't it Einstein that said if we keep doing the same thing and making the same mistakes, we're crazy?
It's the definition of stupidity, isn't that? Thank you so much, John. I'd love to get to work on some sort. I want a chopper. Can I have a personal chopper, Laurel?
Could I respond to that? Because he's absolutely right. And we do need to look at the prevailing human desires and the available technology. And it's, surprise, surprise, it's there. It's the driverless car. We can have these linked up into great trains, which economise on the use of urban space. People can keep that lovely desire for the carriage, which goes back to the dawn of history. And we can also make certain we don't devastate our cities by dual six-lane freeways. We can have driverless cars. We can have them ordering up. You can go where you want. And we can have the economical use of road space. So we, as long as we subordinate technology to our own objectives and we utilise our political systems, we can really have, if not all, a very big improvement.
Wouldn't that be good? A very big improvement. I don't know, driverless cars kind of freak me out a little bit. I'd have to adjust my mental space a bit,
Go for it.
They're not allowed in Australia as yet, but I'm sure that's going to change. Though I did have a go on one in the last few weeks. There was a trial shuttle where you sit quietly looking at people on the other side of that shuttle. The seats face each other. And it went at 8 kilometres an hour, so you could walk faster. But it was a trial vehicle. I think the technology is very exciting. I agree with Phil.
Didn't one run into something recently?
About 0.01% of journeys made. It was a trial. Of course you're going to have minor problems.
I mean, fear of change on display right here with me.
Yes, Emma, I often run into things in my car. No one blames technology for that. So that's
Laurel,
all me.
You really should. Listen, a lot of people are actually texting and calling about this particular issue, which Dave in Kapalabar wants to bring up. Dave, what's your concern?
Yes, good morning, Emma. If you look at the problem, we're being sausage machine squeezed into this development at the moment, and the only development that's taking place is in the cities. And we've got this huge continent with the opportunity to produce, and we're shoving everyone into the cities. If you look at wonderful examples overseas like Mattighofen in Austria and places in Germany, they have a township with an enterprise that sustains the whole township. You know, you're driving to Gympie and suddenly there's a township there with a couple of factories and an intermodal transport hub, and that whole area produces the jobs for that community.
Okay.
Yet we're not also asking the simple question, water sustains life. Towns will almost run out of water before this last rain event. And, you know, the political system is just pushing us all in this community towards this current development and not looking at the basic problems.
Of water. Okay. Graham in Bell Bowery. No, Graham wants to talk about development. Randy in Silkstone has said, no one's spoken about water supply. More dams or desalination plants. Without water, you have nothing. Ross in Budrum, where is the water going to come from? Adrian wants to know about environmentally sustainable population growth for Australia and the world. Tina at Tingalpa is worried about yes, the beautiful, fertile red earth of the Redlands that now used to be the salad bowl of Brisbane is now housing estates, and that'll be deeply regretted. So water, food, I mean, that's life-sustaining, isn't it?
Yes.
So what about the water then? Laurel, I'll ask you first.
Thanks, Emma. Well, where's the water going to come from? I guess from the sky in some ways, and I know that's a dreadful answer, but I guess around back to Julie's point about food production as well, the city can be a solution. It doesn't have to be a problem. And the solution of the city can be, I mean, look at the water tanks we all have now in our backyards. We didn't have a decade ago. We have solar panels on our roofs. We're the biggest users of solar power in the world as far as our roof space. Like we're taking up those energy challenges. Urban food production, we're seeing communities on the Sunshine Coast convert their footpaths to food that's shared amongst that community. So we, you know, to problematise is great, and that can bring us to solutions because we're clever. You know, we're adaptable and we're clever as humans. And I think that the city can offer up some solutions to us. We've already started to change our behaviour in the last 10 years with water tanks in our backyards.
Yeah, we did a show a couple of weeks ago around water bills, actually, because that was a huge concern for you if you were listening to that. It's online as well. Phil Davies, Infrastructure Australia, what about water supply in Australia? Is that something that comes across your desk?
Absolutely, Emma. And we also did some work on water that we released late last year. And we this comes back to planning again, that we laid out some concerns that we might see our water bills double over the next 10, 20 years if we don't actually take action. And that comes back to the need for a national plan. We at the moment, the planning is again very localised, and we actually need to be more joined up nationally with a national plan for water, which, you know, would work very well if you developed a national plan for population.
There is so much across your desk with this then, isn't there, Phil? Which, is there one particular federal minister that you deal with the most?
So we've dealt with a number of ministers. The one we have dealt with most, I'd say, is Minister Paul Fletcher, who is the Urban Infrastructure and Transport Minister, so very appropriate, and also very involved in the city deal processes. So,
but I don't imagine that water supply and agricultural land, that comes into his purview, does
no,
it?
No, so urban water, yes, but agricultural productive water is really a matter for the water and agricultural minister.
Okay. We've got a couple more calls coming in. I wanted to ask Ellen, though. Ellen Charles-Edwards, when you look at the population coming into the southeast, and it is a mix of why people are coming here and, you know, babies being born, do you have information on which areas have seen the biggest population growth?
Yeah, we do.
Where are you? There you are. Yes.
Yeah, we do. Thanks, Emma. So there's a lot of variation around SEQ. So in terms of the
most numbers of people, the Gold Coast and Brisbane take sort of the lion's share. But if we look at the rate of growth, so I guess where the biggest local impact is, it's more Sunshine Coast, Ipswich Corridor. We're getting very high levels of growth, particularly relative to the number of people that have already lived there. So that's where some of the biggest impacts are. The drivers of growth does vary. So in Brisbane, Gold Coast, Logan, it's a lot of international migration. So people coming from New Zealand and England and China and India. In other parts of SEQ, it's more internal migration. So somewhere like Noosa or Sunshine Coast, you have people moving from other states and territories to make their home there.
And How dare they?
I know. and then births, it's, you know, pretty evenly distributed, higher fertility in the rural and suburban areas.
Right. Mm. And is that because families need to...
Families need space to grow, you know. It's, yeah. I mean, I've got a little one and we're living in the inner city Brisbane at the moment, but if we go to two, I guess we'll be looking to move out to the suburbs, so...
Just put them on the balcony.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's one
option.
Sorry,
I'm feeling very facetious today, aren't I? Now, we've got 10 more minutes. Shirley in Yeronga. Shirley, you've got an idea for your area.
I've got an idea for the whole of Brisbane beyond the University of Queensland. I've been beating the drum to try and get a CityCat service further upstream from UQ and probably for the last 2.5 years with absolutely zero result. I mean, you know, we just had nothing, and yet we've got so much support. I've had so many petitions and I've handed them over to council. I've gone to Mark Bailey, I've gone to, you know, who's our local member, but also, you know, infrastructure. You know, and we've just had no luck, and the arguments are really pretty poor.
What do you get? What argument do you get back?
Oh, probably the biggest one is they say that the wake from created by the city cats when the banks aren't sealed further upriver. But, you know, we're into the third generation of city cats these days, and they are designed and manufactured for low wake and low water.
What are they worried the wake will do? Like it will splash on people's backyards and into their pools?
No, I think more that it'll cave in the riverbanks. You know,
oh, just that. Okay.
Yeah. So, but the thing is that, you know, for the cost of a bridge, of one bridge, then, you know, we can do, you know, maintain and sustain the river and, you know, put in some kind of banks, so, you know, concrete and things or rocks or whatever to hold those banks. And we can do it for the, you know, and do two or three terminals for the same money that one bridge costs. You know, we're having 500,000 river crossings a day.
Gee, Shirley's put some thought into it. I tell you what, Shirley, Veronica is also asking this, saying, can someone please explain why our Brisbane River of 344 kilometres is not being discussed broadly as an urgent and key piece of almost ready-to-go transport infrastructure? Mm-hmm. Laurel, is it ready to go?
I can just from our perspective this morning, coming here from the University of Queensland, and from what we know about student use of our campus and how students travel.
You mean actually travelling here to
the
South Bank Studios?
It's a slow boat. And so we know our students, we've had a look at go-kart data to see how they're moving to and from University of Queensland, taking buses at an extraordinarily much larger rate than they are using the CityCat service. It's just too slow.
Did you get the CityCat here this morning?
No, no way. It just takes too long.
So how did you get here?
The number 66 bus, which is a regular service and takes us right here. So I think the river has its limitations in that that's a great mode of transport. It'll get you to other points along the river, obviously, but it's a slow boat.
It's a slow boat.
And it's competing with much faster modes.
To the CBD. Phil Haywood, you've worked on transport plans.
Yes, I've got three quick points to make. The first is to beat my breast and say, I remember on a program like this 30 years ago saying, oh, yes, they can't do that. It would destroy the riverbanks from all the backwash, and how wrong I was. So, of course, it's a good idea. Of course, we can reinforce the riverbanks. That's about urban progress, isn't it? So, first of all, it's a great idea. Second point, we really do need to make much more use of the main axis of the river from east to west. At the moment, we over-commercialise and have storage plants and gateway port facilities down the lower estuary. There's a whole possibility of intensifying that as a belt of quite intensive residential population and moving industry out to other ports where it's better located. So that's a very quick general point. And the third point was that lady, what was her first name?
Well, that was Shirley.
That was Shirley. Shirley, how good that was, and how much we need more Shirleys putting more ideas into the public arena and starting off from consultation, insights, innovation, and then winnowing that out, getting the information from experts like Emma, and then seeing which of those bright ideas work.
I'm an expert.
That's right. I'm all experts.
I'm an instant expert.
That's right.
A few more minutes. We'll take one more call. Barbara in Redcliffe, what are you most worried about?
I'm just amazed that no one has brought up the issue of decentralisation. We're not a country of only five major cities. We're a country of many regional cities.
It was on my list.
Well, I missed it. I'm sorry.
No, why, Barbara, sorry. You bring up a good point. And, well,
I just can't believe it. If the government encouraged businesses, government departments, healthcare services, all of those things into our regional cities, people would go there.
Mm.
You know, people who are looking for work, who are looking for accommodation, which is not as expensive as it is in the major cities, they would go there because there are lovely places to live anyway.
Let's ask Ellen Charles Edwards then. Do they go there? Will they go there?
Look, I think we should be certainly looking at decentralisation, and you're exactly right. It's about jobs. We need to have really vibrant industries and employment sectors to attract migrants. I think we're starting to see that in cities such as Newcastle, which is attracting, not refugees quite, but people flowing from Sydney. But yeah, I mean, if there's the support, we can maybe think about decentralisation of the public service to get jobs into, you know, regional parts of Queensland. The problem is the public servants who do that plan tend to want their jobs to stay in Brisbane, so it's often quite difficult to get a lot of traction for that sort of policy.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because if you've got family networks, kids in school, grandparents that help look after them, how can you move? So is it something that's more open to people who move here from overseas or interstate? Like, should we be putting more public servants in Noosa so that they can look after all those people that move there from the southern states? Phil Davies, you're not planning on retiring to Noosa, are you?
No, I like the sound of that. I think.
Phil Davies from Infrastructure Australia, do you think we can get there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what we'd like to see is the debate about how much we grow, a debate about not how much we grow, but how we grow, and I think we can get there. We've done this before, but we do need to engage the community in this conversation. We need to look at what choices we have. Then we need to roll our sleeves up, get all levels of government working together and get the planning, long-term planning right. And I think the important point just made around off Barbara's question with decentralisation, you know, one of the choices is moving jobs closer to where people live, and that should be on the table as a possibility.
Mm. Well, Phil Davies, it's been great to have you on the show this morning. Really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you very much, Emma.
Phil's from Infrastructure Australia. And the other Phil, Professor Phil Haywood from QUT's School of Urban Planning. Phil, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the enjoyable conversation.
Oh, and from UQ, Laurel Johnson, urban and social planner, and Ellen Charles Edwards, population geographer and demographer. You love numbers. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks to your clever callers too.
Ah, they're wonderful, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for your calls and your texts. There are some that we did not get to today, but you can hear our catch-up with Jacob Roebuck on Friday, where we'll be going over what's happened this week. Also, if you do have something to say, now you're thinking about this and you want to chime in, well, you can always by email. You can email the Focus team. The address is focusbrisbane@abc.net.au. And I'll be back with you tomorrow between 10 and 11. Tomorrow we are having a look at gun laws. And this comes from what's happened in the United States, of course. Australia's always held up as the ideal situation, or at least much better than the United States. Are we in that situation? What is it like? You'll be hearing from all sides of the argument, as usual, on Focus tomorrow between 10 and 11. That's with me, Emma Griffiths. Right now, stay listening for Richard Feidler with Conversations, and then you will get The World Today. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 10.
Every day is a new beginning.
And as the stories break in Brisbane,
we're all over it.
Craig Zonka and Rebecca Livingston.
Weekday mornings from 6 on ABC Radio Brisbane.